and welcome to the International Trade Resource Podcast, your go-to source for insights and information on all aspects of international trade. Whether you're an entrepreneur, a trade professional, or just curious about the global marketplace, we've got you covered. From customs regulations to export strategies, from emerging markets to international finance, we explore the latest trends and best practices that drive global commerce. Our host, Kim Kirkendall, sits down with a diverse range of experts who navigate the complex world of international trade and help you stay ahead of the game. So get ready to learn about the ins and outs of international trade on the International Trade Resource Podcast.
Hello, listeners. I want to welcome you again to another episode of the International Trade Resources Podcast. And we're drilling down today on a very popular topic on our podcast, which was export controls. We're going to get a little deeper today in conversation about compliance for export controls and how you can research and understand and audit your customers better to give you the information you need to be compliant with regulations. And this is primarily for exporting, but many other countries have very similar regulations. And so I know many of our listeners are around the world, not just in the United States. So joining us today is Josh Rodman, and he is an associate attorney right now with Sandler, Travis, and Rosenberg. He was an attorney previously, or has been an attorney for a number of years, was with the previous firm before this, before STR. He's been with them for a few years now. And then before that, working as an attorney for the previous firm, he was with Lockheed Martin. I really want to focus on his area of specialty, which is sanction and export compliance, government procurement, and CFIUS. So you can see by his focus, by his background, that he has a tremendous amount of experience in this topic. And I'm really thankful, Josh, that you can be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly. I really appreciate it. And I thank you in advance to the listeners for taking the time to join us today to discuss export controls.
Well, I want to lay the land out a little bit. Most of our listeners are mid-management professionals in international trade, but there's a lot of alphabet soup going on when it comes to export controls. And we have Department of Commerce, Department of Treasury, we have OFAC regulations, we have EAR regulations, we have, you know, the Bureau of Industry and Security, we have a lot of different organizations. Yes. So can you lay out for us very briefly what organizations, what parts of this alphabet soup do our listeners need to be aware of? And then we'll jump into the real questions.
That sounds great, Kimberly. That's a great question. I would say, to break it down to the most simplest form here, we have three primary agencies and then sub-agencies within them that govern export controls. We have the Department of Commerce, Bureau of Industry and Security, and you mentioned the Export Administration Regulations, that those regulations are administered by the Bureau of Industry and Security. So the Department of Commerce Bureau of Industry and Security regulations apply to commercial dual use items. So this corpus of regulations may be of particular interest to a lot of your listeners that are not necessarily in the defense space, but are in the consumer space, in the electronic space, a whole host of regular products, non-military products, are subject to commerce BIS regulations. Secondly, I would mention the Department of State and DDTC. Similar to commerce and BIS, the Department of State and DDTC regulate the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations. They are responsible for the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations, the ITAR, which applies to defense articles. So when we're talking about exporting products out of the United States, they're either subject to export controls under the EAR or the ITAR, either commerce or state, right? And BIS and DDTC are the sub-agencies within commerce and state that administer those rules. The third primary agency is the Office of Foreign Assets Control within the United States Department of Treasury, which is the agency responsible for administering the sanctions regulations. So just to recap, when we're talking about export controls that apply to products, we're talking about commerce and state rules, and then Treasury and OFAC rules step in when we're talking about sanctions. And so I would also think we should mention U.S. Customs, because to the extent any products are being exported from the U.S., U.S. Customs has the opportunity to detain exports outbound for any commerce, state, or Treasury concerns related to that shipment. Was that a helpful breakdown, Kimberly?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. We want to interweave the discussion today in talking about how these regulations are applied and the mistakes that companies make in underestimating or not recognizing their products are on a list or that the companies they're dealing with are on a list. But we also want to talk about, you know, how important it is to know your customer. So I'm going to start there. Many companies, you know, as they grow in export, so many U.S. companies start selling domestically, you know, and then they slowly start exporting when they have customers reach out to them. And it's not necessarily a strategic plan. It happens as the business grows. And so they don't necessarily stop and think to themselves, you know, what regulations are there around export? What do I need to be knowledgeable about? And they don't think about auditing their customers. They're concerned about getting paid by international customers, but they're not necessarily concerned about what other information should they be gathering about their customers. And so let's start there. What kind of advice would you give companies about the type of information they need to be gathering about their customers internationally?
Yeah. So the first reason why gathering information on your customers is important, Kimberly, is because if you don't, you can go to jail under U.S. export control laws and OFAC rules, right? So that's what I want to highlight for the listeners, that when it comes to the export control laws and the sanctions laws, there is the potential for criminal penalties to attach to violations. So many folks don't know that. And that certainly gives business folks an appreciation for the seriousness with which they need to take export control. So digging into your customer is highly important, Kimberly. And customer has many different meanings depending on a company's business model, right? For companies that are operating abroad through a distributor model, for example, where their customer is the distributor and the business has very little insight into who is the customer beyond the distributor, that kind of arrangement potentially carries with it a lot of risk under the export control laws and under the sanctions laws.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. I'm glad you're bringing that up, because I think a lot of U.S. companies mistakenly believe that the company they sell to is where their responsibility ends. So please go ahead.
Yeah. So what I would say to that is a company's responsibility does not end at their sale to a distributor, subject to certain conditions, Kimberly. As a general matter, though, I would never advise one of my clients that their responsibilities simply end at the time that they consummate their sale to a distributor. So depending on the country that the distributor is located in, and depending on the export control level of the product or products at issue, then additional digging and research on who the end users, on who the subsequent customers will be after the distributor takes possession of the goods, is required under the export control reg. So let's speak in terms of real examples. If we're talking about exporting an item that is EAR 99, or in other words, subject to the least level of export controls, and that item is being sold into a European country to a distributor, that general example of a kind of transaction is very different than the kind of distributor transaction where a U.S. company, for example, is selling into China through a distributor and is dealing in export-controlled electronics, for example. In that kind of example, the U.S. company would certainly need to either get additional information from the distributor itself as to who the subsequent customers will be, or we'll have to get written assurances from the distributor as to who the subsequent customers will not be, as to what the end uses of the particular products will be, so that there is no violation of the export control laws in terms of end uses, not just in terms of who the party is receiving them. So the level of diligence required, Kimberly, in terms of a distributor model is highly dependent on the country, the products at issue, and, you know, the relevant data points that we look to in terms of assessing risk for an export transaction.
And that brings us really to our next question. But before we get to there, I want to comment that in your customer mapping, it's the same situation for a company, because we recently had a client out of New Zealand who was shipping product into the United States, doing some light assembly in the U.S. and then shipping that product to Brazil or South America. In that situation, even though they're a foreign company, they're a New Zealand company, they're shipping that product out of the U.S., they still have to follow U.S. export regulations. So, you know, you can get caught up in this in, you know, for a variety of reasons. But you ended what you were saying by talking about, you know, customer, product, country.
Yes.
So those are the trigger points for a lot of these regulations. Why don't you talk about those in particular?
Sure. So let's start with country and product first, because I think those are relatively easier of the three. So the country, of course, refers to the country to which the product is being exported. And more specifically, we're talking about where the product will be used. Now, to the extent we're talking about an export transaction that involves multiple countries, then it could be that the country assessment must be done on a multiple country basis. And so when talking about countries, it depends on the export transaction itself and whether the product is simply going to one country and will be used there, or whether the product will transit through numerous countries before arriving in the country of end use. Okay, turning to product, what we're talking about in terms of product is the export classification of the product. And now this goes back to what we spoke about at the beginning of the podcast, Kimberly, in terms of the Department of Commerce, Bureau of Industry and Security, and the Department of State, Directorate of Defense Trade Control rules. Okay, so if you have a commercial dual use item subject to the Department of Commerce Export Administration regulations, or if you have a defense article subject to Department of State ITAR rules, then the export licensing requirements and all the associated compliance requirements will be dictated by those rules. So more specifically, Kimberly, for commercial dual-use items controlled under the Department of Commerce's rules, the Export Administration Regulations, what we're looking at there is the Export Control Classification Number of the item, or the ECCN. Okay, and there are 10 categories under the Export Administration Regulations of what's called the Commerce Control List. And so companies have to assess an item against the Commerce Control List to determine the ECCN. Companies can do this assessment themselves if they're able to, or they can use outside advisors to do that. Or, Kimberly, companies can apply directly to the Department of Commerce for the Department of Commerce to tell them the control level of an item. And that's something called a CCATS request or a commodity classification request. And that can be made directly to the Department of Commerce. Similarly, if an item is not commercial dual use, but rather a defense article, then the United States munitions list under the International Trafficking in Arms Regulations, under the Department of State rules, must be scrubbed, and the ITAR classification for the item must be determined. If you have a defense article controlled under the ITAR, Kimberly, those items are subject to the highest level of controls under our export laws and almost always require an export license. However, for commercial dual-use items controlled under the Export Administration Regulations, under the Department of Commerce's rules, depending on the ECCN, depending on the country it's going to, that will dictate whether an export license is required. Okay, and that covers country and product. Now, turning to customer. So, like we spoke about earlier, customer does not only refer to the end user, for example, but the sanctions rules, the export control rules under United States law require that all parties to the transaction be screened, not just the end user or not just the customer that you're selling to, but to the extent there are any intermediary parties, Kimberly, or any intermediary consignees or other parties that will take possession of the goods, all those parties need to be screened. And to the extent an export license is being applied for, all those parties need to be referenced in the export license application. We can get into export license applications if you wish. But when it comes to customers and understanding who a particular customer is, this can be complex or risky depending on the countries we're talking about, the level of relationship a U.S. Company has with a particular customer. For example, if we're talking about exporting product to Russia or to certain countries bordering Russia in particular now, and the government has actually put out new guidance on this. But to the extent you have a U.S. exporter being told to ship product to a former Soviet Union country on the Russian border, and it is a product that was previously being sold into Russia, then that U.S. company needs to do a lot more digging on the end user, where the end user is located, whether the product is staying in the country that they're being told, or whether there's a chance the product is being diverted into Russia. And when I speak, you know, when I give that example, there are those types of risky transactions all over the world, whether we're talking about the Middle East, whether we're talking about China, Venezuela. That's something that must be drilled down. Also, Kimberly, I just want to mention one more thing because I've focused on export controls a little bit. But when we're talking about our customer and sanctions rules, of course, customers must be screened against the restricted party list. I think we're going to get into a little bit later in the podcast, a free resource available to your listeners that they can use, that's available to them from the United States government that they can use to screen customers. But I want to take the opportunity to talk about the OFAC 50% rule here when talking about customers. So one thing that many of your listeners may not know is that the Department of Treasury puts out a list called the Specially Designated Nationals List, the SDN list, among other lists that Treasury puts out. And individuals and companies that are on the SDN list cannot be transacted with without a license. And the Department of Treasury typically doesn't issue licenses to anyone on the Specially Designated Nationals list. And I'm being generous there when I say that. But the Department of Treasury has a rule that says, the 50% rule, that says to the extent you have a company or an entity that is 50% owned or controlled by an individual or entity that is on the SDN list, but the entity we're talking about here itself is not on the SDN list, then that entity is subject to the same sanctions as the SDN listed entity that 50% owns or controls it. However, the complexity here, Kimberly, is there is no list for the OFAC 50% rule. Companies have to do, U.S. companies have to do their own research to understand whether they're potentially violating the OFAC 50% rule. So more specifically, when you're screening a customer, if you're dealing with customer XYZ Inc. and customer XYZ Inc. is not on the SDN list, but customer XYZ Inc. is 50% owner controlled by a company or individual that is on the SDN list, then a U.S. company is prohibited from dealing with XYZ Inc. However, simply running a restricted party screen will not tell you that XYZ Inc. is subject to the 50% rule. So that's a level of diligence that companies have to engage in over and above restricted party screening.
And I hope as you're speaking that our listeners understand why we started with country, product, customer, because I hope they see that it's clear those don't exist in isolation. So you have to look at your product, is it the trigger? And it may be the trigger if it's combined with a certain customer, or if it's combined with a certain country, or the country on its own may be a trigger. right? So it's understanding that all three of these things, there's interplay with each other. So that brings us really to the next question, which is, how would you approach this? So if you're a company trying to understand, does this apply to me or not? How am I going to approach this?
So the way I would approach this, Kim, is through a simple construct of who, what, and where. Who being the customer and the other parties to the transaction, who referring to the entities and individuals that must be screened. They must be subject to restricted party screening. And on this point, I should say that the U.S. federal government puts out something called the Consolidated Screening List, the CSL. This is located on trade.gov. Your listeners can Google search the Consolidated Screening List at trade.gov. It's a completely free screening tool made available by the government to the public that allows you to run your own restricted party screening. It even has a fuzzy name function that allows you to run restricted parties where you don't have a complete name for the party, and it will pull parties with similar names. But your listeners will see when they access the CSL that there's fields there to input the address, the country information related to the customer, and some optionality there. And it's a great tool. And I would say everyone should start there. Above that, your listeners should know that there are export compliance software tools available to companies that can be purchased from companies like Amber Road, OCR. And I do not mention those because I have any relationship or derive any benefit from them whatsoever. I'm just merely mentioning the companies that I know that my clients regularly refer to in terms of what they use. Those tools have enterprise level capabilities where customer lists can be screened on an automated basis, for example, which is a great functionality. So that speaks to the who. When we talk about what, we're talking about the export control level of the product, more specifically the ECCN of the product or the ITAR classification, the United States Munitions List classification of the product in the case of a defense article. Okay, and as we said before, companies can do their own export classification assessment under the EAR, the Commerce Control List, and under the ITAR, the United States Munitions List, or they can refer to outside experts, or they can have the government tell them what the classification level is, again, under the commerce rules through something called a CCATS request using a tool called SNAP-R. These are all free tools available by the Department of Commerce, or through something called a commodity jurisdiction request through the Department of State for a defense article subject to the ITAR. So when we're talking about what, we're talking about the export control level of the product, the ECCN or the ITAR classification of the product, in combination with next, where the country it's going to dictates the export licensing and associated compliance requirements. So you have to know your customer and all parties involved in the transaction. You have to know the ECCN or USML classification of your product. And you have to know where the product is going, all the intermediate stops and parties along the way, and critically, whether there's an opportunity for diversion, Kimberly. When talking about Russia, China, Venezuela, countries located around them, it's critical that U.S. companies understand whether they're dealing in an export transaction where the products are going to be diverted to a sanctioned or otherwise embargoed country, even though they're selling to a country in the first instance that is not subject to sanction or embargo. So this goes back to what we were talking about before, the level of due diligence and review that the listeners have to go through when talking about export compliance.
Well, that brings us, I think, to some actionable items we can share with our listeners as we wrap the podcast up. So obviously, they have to do their research, you know, and you've outlined very clear methods for them and organizations and entities that they can use to research, you know, who, what, and where. But when it comes to the who part, when it comes to the customer, a lot of it revolves around gathering information and asking questions to that customer. So I'm a huge fan of procedures, you know, and nobody likes forms, right? But forms can be very useful. So in terms of company procedures and policy that would create the structure that the company needs to make sure that their sales team, because we also all know that the sales team oftentimes so excited, got a new order, XYZ customer in Belarus, everything looks great. They don't necessarily go back to the compliance team, you know, or to another department if something isn't set up in the system. So what can a company do to strengthen its systems, its procedures, how it's gathering information from its customers, so that this becomes a daily part of business and not something that somebody has to say, oh, you know, heck, we should do this, right? It should be embedded in your company. So what would you suggest?
Yeah, what I would suggest, Kimberly, and I do this with clients regularly, is if you're a company that's exporting out of the United States and you don't have written policies and procedures that your employees are trained on either annually or biannually, then you are running the risk of having numerous different potential export compliance risks sort of fall on your company. So in terms of what companies should do, companies need to have written policies and procedures that employees are trained on annually or biannually, which those time periods account for the regular changes in export controls. The last year or two has seen a rapid expansion in export controls and sanctions laws, changes, developments, expansions where they didn't exist before, in terms of China, Russia, Venezuela, other countries. And if your company is not doing annual or biannual training on these issues, I don't see how it could even be remotely possible that your listeners, employees will be up to speed in the way they need to be in terms of a company that is regularly exporting. So I think the simple answer is written policies and procedures have to be in place. And not only do they have to be in place, but they have to be commensurate with the sophistication level of the business. So the policies and procedures when it comes to the who, what, and where have to become a daily part of employees' days when we're talking about a company that's involved in exporting product. And so a company needs to figure out how it needs to get to a place where its employees are up to speed. But in the first instance, training is the best place to start. And to the extent sales folks or other outward facing teams are not familiar with export compliance or as familiar as they should be, then they can be brought up to speed with training. So I think the answer is, Kimberly, that a company has to have written policies and procedures that are commensurate with the sophistication level of the business. And that is what the Department of Commerce or the Department of State would expect to see if a company were to be investigated for potential export control violations. To the extent a company doesn't have any written policies and procedures and they are exporting, that is a huge red flag and would need to be corrected immediately, in my view.
I'm glad, you know, glad to hear you say that, because it supports my love of policies and procedures. I would also highlight for our listeners that within the structure of what Josh is talking about in policies and procedures is that the company is going to do research, you know, primary data, which in this situation would be a customer intake form that includes a lot of the questions that you need to have answered, including, you know, who are their customers if they're a distributor, who are the intermediaries that are involved in this, the fact that the company has a right to have all of that information, secondary data, you know, going into researching the companies that may be involved in your industry with your product in this particular situation, and doing secondary data research on your customer, distributor, their potential customers, to validate that they don't have a location in a restricted country, or that they don't potentially have the same type of business that a dual use product could be used in a military application, not just a commercial application. Also, I think what comes into play here is an agreement with your distributor or your customer that spells out your expectations. and talks about, you know, what your guidelines are for how your product can be used, what information should be shared back with you, because this product falls under U.S. government regulation for EAR, ITAR, whatever. And those are all things that fit under the umbrella of policies and procedures that Josh brought up. But I want to make sure we you know, elevate that a little bit for our listeners, you know, and we're going to have to wrap up here. I'm afraid this is one of those topics that we could pick any one of these segments and drill even deeper. And maybe in a future podcast, we will. But thanks again, Josh, for making the time and joining us and helping to educate our listeners. I look forward to, you know, future opportunities to work with you and encourage our listeners to connect with Josh on LinkedIn. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kimberly.
That's all for this episode of the International Trade Resource Podcast. We hope you found this discussion insightful and informative. To find more episodes and more information on all things international trade, check out our website at www.intltraderesources.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review on your favorite platform to help us spread the word. Join us next time for more exciting insights on the global marketplace. Until then, keep thinking globally.